Hi, I'm Marco Werman, host of The World. I want to say thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. You hear from us all the time on the show. Our fundraiser is when we get to hear from you, like Mary from Massachusetts, who shared this. The World has been an invaluable resource to keep me connected to the wider world, she writes. I teach AP Human Geography, and it connects to course content all the time and gives me recent news to share with my students. Thank you for making my commute much more interesting. And thank you for those kind and encouraging words, Mary. From now through December 31st, we have the opportunity to double your donation. A generous donor has offered to match your gift dollar for dollar if we collectively raise $67,000. We need your help to get there. Visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. And now, the show.
Chinese censors are cracking down on internet access, strengthening the Great Firewall to squelch protest. But just how far will they go?
Unless China wants to really look a lot more like North Korea, I don't think it's going to be possible for them to completely ban VPNs.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead this hour, some good news for kids. After years in detention camps in Iraq and Syria, children of ISIS suspects are thriving back home.
By and large, these children are doing well. They are living with families, they're going to school, playing football, or riding on scooters, playing with Lego.
And that's not the only time you'll hear the word football this hour. Meet Cameroon's growling superfan. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Good to have you with us on this Friday. Britain's Prince William is here in Boston today to present his Earthshot Prize, awarded to innovators around the world working on saving nature and combating global warming. Prince William says he chose the city because it's the hometown of President Kennedy.
"We choose to go to the moon," he said, "not because it is easy, but because it is hard."
That's a quote from a 1962 speech President Kennedy gave about the moonshot, an effort to achieve the seemingly impossible feat of delivering a human to the moon.
"That goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept."
The goal of the Earthshot Prize is to focus on climate solutions, just like the Moonshot did on getting to the moon. Over $1 million is being awarded to each of the five winners. Joining me to discuss the prize is Rachel Kite, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. She's part of the host committee for the ceremony here in Boston. Dean Kite, Prince William's Earthshot Prize is in its second year now, and it promises to disperse nearly $60 million by the end of the decade. That's a drop in the bucket in terms of the funding needed for climate action. So why are prizes like this important?
Well, I think prizes do a number of things beyond just the cash that goes to the winners. They draw attention of other potential funders, whether they be private investors or philanthropists, to those ideas which show the greatest promise on the things that we need to do the most towards and the fastest areas of progress. Some of the winners are emblematic of other people who are trying to do the same thing. So I think that they will attract money and funding and support, technical support, not just to the winners, but to others in that space.
What and who are some of the finalists you're most excited about this year?
Clean air is really important because, you know, at times when people don't understand what climate is, everybody knows that they want to have clean air for their kids. And so you see clean stoves. We have a Kenyan clean stove company in the list. But we also have low emission vehicles, making them affordable for people on low income in the cities of Africa. So Rome, Kenya is on the list. And then, of course, you've got new batteries for emission-free vehicles, which is, you know, the fastest growing area of sort of clean technology worldwide. So that's just on air. In oceans, we've got stopping the plastic pollution that is such a big problem, all the way through to the indigenous women of the Great Barrier Reef. It is indigenous knowledge that knows how to take care of ecosystems.
Is the idea of the Earthshot Prize a way to kind of give a kind of jolt of money to an organization to allow it to kind of scale up?
Well, I think that the ambition that the now Prince of Wales has shown is that we're in a climate crisis. We're in a waste and pollution crisis. We're in a biodiversity and species extinction crisis. And we've got to have the kind of ambition, an earth shot, as we had the ambition to go to the moon. It has to be of that scale. We should test ourselves against this incredible series of crises that we have created. And I think what he's trying to do is raise our eyes to the horizon ahead of us. We can do this, but we've got to mobilize ourselves, and we've got to really get behind the entrepreneurs and the community activists who can see the world differently. They can close their eyes and imagine a world with clean air, imagine a world with clean oceans. And I think he's saying, let's be as good as them and let's test ourselves against this crisis.
The British royal family, they have a complicated history globally. I mean, to many, they're the human representations of colonialism and historic inequalities. What's the implication of the royal family administering a prize like this?
Well, I think that we saw in the opening ceremony, you know, a clear reference to the elements of the climate struggle, which have to be about climate justice. The people that have done the least to bring about this point of crisis, those who were colonialized, those who have been voiceless, these are the most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And you cannot talk about climate action without understanding the history of how we got here and the power sort of dynamics within the global economy. That's fundamental to climate action. And I think that the Prince and Princess or the Earthshot organizers, you know, are not shying away from that. And, you know, for as long as we have the kinds of societies we do, that we have royal families, then having them use their undoubted influence, having them use their voice and their agency to try to move the world in a better direction, I think that's a good thing.
Rachel Kite is Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you.
It wasn't supposed to be like this. Following the surprise vote in favor of Brexit in 2016, Britain chartered its course for getting out of the European Union. That was supposed to usher in bright economic horizons, including a lucrative new free trade deal with the United States. But now, 2 years after Brexit took effect, Britain is in a recession and inflation is at a 40-year high. And that trade deal with America? It's nowhere in sight. So what went wrong? The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry explains.
Before that referendum, 6 years ago, this was the sort of thing the pro-Brexit lawmakers were telling the British public.
I genuinely believe our future will be so much brighter if we vote Leave and take back control of our trade.
That's Conservative MP Andrea Leadsom. Here's her party colleague Michael Gove, one of the most prominent Brexit diehards.
The day after we vote to leave, we hold all the cards and we can choose the path that we want.
Britain did vote to leave, and 3 years later, Boris Johnson was elected UK Prime Minister. He promised a bright economic future too.
We could strike free trade deals with America.
And in Washington, the American president said Johnson's win was brilliant news for both countries.
I want to congratulate Boris Johnson on a terrific victory. And it's going to be a great thing for the United States also, because it means a lot of trade, tremendous amount of trade. They want to do business with us so badly.
Trump was right, at least about one thing. The UK really did want to do business. Clark Packard is a trade policy expert with the Cato Institute in Washington. He says there were always big hurdles in forging a new UK-US deal, and one of them was chicken.
I think the outstanding issue of chlorinated chicken is a long-standing issue. You know, the US chicken exporters really wanted access to Europe and the UK market, but you had some concerns on that side of the Atlantic that would have prohibited that or made that a pretty tricky subject.
By the time Britain officially left the EU in 2020 and was free to actually start negotiating trade deals, Packard says President Trump's attention was elsewhere. Now, under President Biden, a deal looks even more improbable, he says.
The Biden administration has shown zero willingness to put market access issues on the table in any sort of trade negotiation.
David Hennig agrees. He's a former UK trade negotiator. He says one of many sticking points is Northern Ireland.
With Biden, there have been issues around his support for the Northern Ireland peace process, and the UK government may be doing things, threatening to not follow the agreement they come to with the EU over Northern Ireland that has made him not even want to try, not even want to go close to it.
Last month, Britain's new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, met President Biden for the first time in his official capacity. But talk of a trade deal wasn't even on the table. Britain has made deals with some other countries, like Australia, for example. In fact, the Australian Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, said he'd never seen a free trade deal signed off so fast.
For us, the quickest major FTA we have ever negotiated, and to do that through a pandemic is quite extraordinary.
Australian cattle farmers like Wayne Williams were happy too.
Any free trade agreement with the UK will be good for Australia and anyone on the land.
Good for anyone on the land, he told Channel 4 News in Britain. But farmers in the UK were not happy. And last month, a British lawmaker who helped secure that deal conceded that they were right to worry.
The first step is to recognise that the Australia trade deal is not actually a very good deal for the UK.
George Eustace said that Liz Truss, who was Britain's trade secretary at the time, was so desperate to sign the agreement that UK negotiators gave away far too much to their Australian counterparts. Now the British government has a new deal in its sights, with India. Sunak is the UK's first Prime Minister of Asian origin. But former trade negotiator David Hennig says getting a deal with India will not be easy.
India is historically pretty reluctant to get into trade deals, pretty reluctant to give anything away in them, certainly as much as the UK wanted to achieve.
And after the disappointing agreement with Australia, Rishi Sunak appears to be far more cautious this time around. He says he'll only sign a deal with India if it's right for Britain. But Sunak also really needs a win right now. Last month, the OECD predicted that the UK economy will fare worse than all other G20 countries next year, except for one, and that's Russia. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
French President Emmanuel Macron visited a former French colony today, New Orleans. It was his final stop on a three-day state visit to the U.S. He was greeted on the tarmac in the only way the city knows how, with a brass band and a parade. Crowds piled into Jackson Square in the French Quarter to welcome the president. Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser was there. He spoke with WDSU.
To just have the president, it tops the cake in showing how important that French culture is here in Louisiana.
Now, there was a time when you could visit one of the small towns in the Louisiana Bayou and not hear a word of English, but not anymore. The old French dialects of Louisiana are fading away. As recently as the late 1960s, around 1 million people spoke French in the state. The 2020 census showed that number down to about 100,000. And that's where Emmanuel Macron comes in. Speaking to the French community in Washington this week, Macron announced an initiative to support French language learning in the United States.
Mais on veut aussi que la langue française soit une langue pour toutes et tous.
We must overhaul the image of the French language in the U.S., Macron said. Instead of being heard as elitist, it should be known as the language of freedom. Will McGrew runs an all-French TV station in Louisiana. He told France 24 that he hopes President Macron will put his money where his mouth is.
On a besoin pas seulement du soutien symbolique, mais aussi...
McGrew says French speakers need more than symbolic support. They need practical support and funding. That's so the French language doesn't become a thing of the past, he says, but instead an opportunity for the future of Louisiana and for France. The visit is not all business. Macron planned to head to the French Quarter himself to see the sights and hear some jazz. Coming up, an alliance between American tech companies and Ukraine.
The spirit which was in the room that time showed us that a lot of people are standing together with Ukraine.
Plus, everybody knows about online censorship in China, but some internet users have long had an easy tech fix to get around it. But now Beijing is cracking down on that, too. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Since 2015, hundreds of U.S. troops have been fighting alongside Kurds against ISIS in northern Syria. Now the U.S. military could be without those allies on the ground. The Syrian Democratic Forces, largely made up of Kurdish fighters, says it will no longer coordinate with the U.S. The announcement follows bombing by the Turkish military and ongoing threats of a Turkish military invasion into Syria. To understand what this means, we're joined now by Charles Lister. He's the director of the Syria program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Charles, can you remind us who the Syrian Democratic Forces are and what they've been doing in northern Syria near the Turkish border?
So the Syrian Democratic Forces are an umbrella under which we have significant Kurdish militia and a range of Arab tribes and ethnic minority militias. And they've all been fighting alongside the United States and the international coalition in northeastern Syria against ISIS since 2014 and 2015.
And why are the Syrian Democratic Forces now no longer coordinating with the US military?
I think it's actually an open question as to whether or not they really are not coordinating with us. I think, frankly, they have no choice but to continue to. The SDF is a declared enemy of Turkey across the border to the north, whilst also being our partner on the ground. But they also have an enemy in northeastern Syria, a very active enemy, ISIS. What they are trying to send by sending this signal publicly is a message to the United States. They are trying to coerce us to do more to prevent a Turkish incursion into northeastern Syria, which would threaten their immediate sort of existence.
So the issue here is that Turkey suspects that the Syrian Democratic Forces are allies of the PKK, a Kurdish militant organization that Turkey and the U.S. consider a terrorist group. So why is Turkey escalating their bombing of northern Syria now?
So there's two things at play. Turkey feels a need to continue to counter a PKK perceived presence along its border with Syria. And secondarily, they feel a need to expand their control of territory in northern Syria, into which they foresee Syrian refugees being able to return. And that, to combined in a sense, is an objective that Erdogan, President Erdogan, needs to be able to achieve in his mind to stand a better chance of winning in the elections in the spring.
So what's going to happen to the U.S. troops who are there if the Syrian Democratic Forces no longer work with them? What are the U.S. troops left with?
So this is not the first Turkish threatened incursion that we've seen over the years. They've launched three ground incursions until now. This would be the fourth. The U.S. troops cannot stay in northeastern Syria to counter ISIS if that partnership with the SDF fully breaks down. And of course, Turkey knows that. They know that continuing to pry away and continuing to poke at this US-SDF relationship, we may eventually find ourselves in a position where we have to withdraw from Syria. It won't have been a crazy decision by President Trump, which we saw before, but it will be a situation that we are forced to have to take. And frankly speaking, the people of northeastern Syria will suffer because ISIS will benefit.
So how serious are the threats of a military invasion by Turkey? I mean, is it a lot of huffing and puffing, or would they really do it?
Frankly speaking, the Turks have been extremely difficult to predict about these things in the past, but they have made it no secret publicly that a ground incursion will happen at some point. Officials have said it could be within days, it could be within weeks, or it could be within months. Honestly, it's not really the United States who's going to be able to prevent this from happening. The more realistic scenario is that Russia will either greenlight a Turkish incursion, or as it's currently the state, will continue to say, you are forbidden from doing this. And the Turkish-Russian relationship is its own dynamic here on this issue. And there are ongoing Turkish-Russian consultations around this potential ground incursion. And frankly, given the NATO situation, Turkey and the United States both being NATO members, there's very little that the United States will be able to do other than essentially asking Turkey not to cross the border.
Charles Lister is the director of the Syria program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Thank you so much, Charles.
Thank you.
ISIS is a shadow of its former self in northern Syria, but there's an ongoing issue there with a large number of people still in detention. They include suspected members of ISIS, but also their relatives and families who lived in areas under ISIS control. They're in detention camps run by Kurdish forces in Syria. The World's Shirin Jafari is here to update us on how the kids in those camps are faring. Shirin, there's a new report out about that. What's the headline?
Carol, this report was put out by Human Rights Watch, and it looks at what happens to children of suspected ISIS members who have been repatriated from detention camps in Syria to their homelands. Let me just give you a quick background here. When the so-called Islamic State came to be, a large number of people went to live in territories controlled by ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. They came from a lot of different countries, from Europe, North America, even from Central Asia. Now, within those families, there were children who were taken to ISIS territories by their parents, or they were born there. And once ISIS was defeated in March 2019, these kids had nowhere else to go. Their home countries would not take them back. And so they basically ended up in huge detention camps in Syria and in Iraq.
If ISIS was defeated more than 3 years ago, why were these detainees not allowed to return to their home countries?
Well, ISIS was an extremely violent group. And so the home countries of these families said, wait a minute, we can't take them back because, first of all, we don't know if they've been involved in some of these crimes that took place in Syria and Iraq. And secondly, what if they pose security threats in our own countries? So these people have simply been stuck in these camps.
So what can you tell us about the living conditions in these camps?
There are two major camps in northeastern Syria. One of them is called Al-Hol and the other one is called Al-Roj. Conditions are bad. Human rights advocates have reported overcrowding, outbreaks of diseases and violence. They say hundreds of children have died because of malnutrition, violence and diseases in these camps.
That sounds pretty grim. Now, I want to go back to this new report. What else did it find?
So human rights groups have for a long time been advocating for these children to be taken back. And they say, look, these children did not travel to ISIS territories out of their own will, and it's unfair to keep them there. Some countries have taken their citizens back. And this new report looks at how these children have been doing since they were taken back. I spoke with Jo Becker, who is the researcher of the report. She said her findings are good news.
We found that by and large, these children are doing well. They are living with families, they're going to school, they're making friends, and they're enjoying typical childhood activities like playing football or riding on scooters, playing with Lego, going to the zoo, going to circus.
Becker said that she has collected information from about 100 children who were returned to seven different countries. Those are France, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, the UK, Kazakhstan, and Uzbekistan.
You know, it sounds like this story is far from over. What's your big takeaway here?
I think what this report shows is that if given the opportunity, these children can return home and they can reintegrate into society successfully. It is complicated and it's not easy. These children need support when they return. At the same time, there are still thousands of kids in camps in Syria and in Iraq. And something, Carol, that I have heard over and over again from experts is that keeping these children in detention camps is not a good long-term solution.
The world's Shireen Jafari, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Carol.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Before this melody became a famous Christmas carol, it was something else entirely. Its Ukrainian roots, celebrated in New York this weekend by a kids' choir.
I just love the melody. I think it's very hypnotizing.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. In China, there's the Great Wall, and then there's the so-called Great Firewall, the name for the vast government censorship network cordoning off Chinese users from much of the internet. But there are clever ways to get past it. One way is a virtual private network, or VPN. Using one disguises a computer's location, allowing users in China to slip past censors and onto banned sites. But as Chinese authorities crack down on protests against the country's zero-COVID policy, VPNs are now in the crosshairs. Jeremy Goldcorn knows all about this. He's the editor-in-chief of The China Project, an online source of news, analysis, and essays about China. Jeremy, how widely used are VPNs in China?
Nobody knows how many people use VPNs. They are certainly widely used geographically all over the country. It's probably a fairly small number of people as a proportion of the population. You know, if I had to guess at a number, I would say no more than 5% of the Chinese population uses them. But the educated urban elite, for especially those who've studied abroad or traveled extensively abroad, for them it's indispensable.
Can you give me some examples of the kinds of sites Chinese people can visit using VPNs?
YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, The New York Times, Wikipedia. Should I go on?
I get the picture. Now, VPNs can disguise your location or allow you to log in securely, remotely. How do they actually work?
Well, what they essentially do is they encrypt the information that is going between your computer and the server of the website you're trying to visit. And they encrypt it in such a way that it's very difficult for the great firewall technology to peek inside and see what's going on. And it doesn't directly visit the server. So what the Chinese Great Firewall software will see is that your computer is visiting a server that belongs to the VPN company. Now, as long as that VPN company's server hasn't been banned, you can get to that server. And it's almost like having a tunnel to the internet outside of China, and nobody can quite see the tunnel, and then you just pop out on the other side.
Hmm. So in the past, did Chinese authorities tolerate VPNs, or were they against the rules, but there were just too many of them to crack down on all of them?
They have always tolerated them for a couple of reasons. One, it is quite a difficult technology to stop. And two, most big corporations have their own virtual private networks, not to evade Chinese censorship, but for security and other reasons, and to allow people working in different offices to access the same set of servers. So it hasn't been a technology that they've wanted to ban because, you know, even their own banks are dependent on it.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I mean, it sounds like VPNs are kind of essential for Chinese to do business.
Unless China wants to really, you know, look a lot more like North Korea, I don't think it's going to be possible for them to completely ban VPNs.
So when did you notice that the Chinese government is starting to get serious about targeting VPNs?
Well, they have always experimented with interfering with them since the earliest days. The Great Firewall itself started in the 1990s, in the very, very early days of the Chinese internet. VPNs started to become really popular in, I'd say, the mid-2000s. I would say that the high watermark of internet freedom in China was probably between 2003 and 2006. And in 2006, the government launched a campaign that they called the Civilized Internet Campaign, where they started increasing censorship on domestic websites and making it more and more difficult to access many foreign websites. And ever since then, it's gradually got stricter and stricter every year. But in the last week, there have been a growing number of reports from all kinds of people, some in the media and some acquaintances, colleagues and friends of mine, who have said that they are struggling with their VPNs.
What are they telling you?
Well, it's just difficult to get on, or the VPN keeps on dropping, or they're not able to access at all, those kind of problems. You know, one of the things that's been happening since the protests started is that the police have been stopping people in some cities and just asking to look at what's on their phones.
Jeremy Goldcorn is editor-in-chief of the China Project. Jeremy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Washington has been concerned about cyber attacks for decades. One suggestion, have D.C. join forces with Silicon Valley. Nothing much had come of that until this past February, when the idea of a public-private partnership took shape. But here's the surprise. The partnership doesn't involve Washington. Rather, it involves Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Dina Temple-Raston has the story.
Volodymyr Pavelko was at a business meeting in the Carpathian Mountains when Russian tanks began to roll into Ukraine.
February 24th at 5 o'clock, I was woken up by my daughter, my elder daughter, and she was crying that, yes, it has begun. I am from Irpin.
That's a suburb of Kyiv.
You see that we have been expecting it for months already. We have been living in such situation for years, at least from 2014.
2014 is when Russia began the annexation of Crimea. And then, just before Christmas, a year later, Russian hackers did something no other hacking group had ever done before. They took down a power grid. Fast forward to Ukraine today.
I'm trying to get warming, yeah. No electricity.
That's Volodymyr again. He says Americans just call him Vol. And when we first started talking to him last month, he was sitting in a book-lined office wearing a beautiful fur-lined vest.
Yeah, it's from Carpathian Mountains, from special animals, yeah, giving their warmth to us, yeah.
When we caught up with him again a few weeks later, the power situation hadn't improved much.
So we don't have electricity for 12 hours per day.
Do you have a generator?
Yes, I have. But unfortunately, the generator doesn't work with all electricity equipment. So electrician, this is my second profession right now.
How are you doing?
Very badly, because I'm not a technical guy.
not a technical guy, he says, which is ironic because he's the co-founder and CEO of a Ukrainian think tank called the Global Cyber Cooperative Center, or GC3, which is all about cyber and technology.
Which is founded in Ukraine to be connected globally.
And one of his jobs is to help the Ukrainian government partner with tech companies to better defend against cyber attacks. The thinking over the years now has been that if Russia was willing to turn out the lights in 2015, it probably wouldn't hesitate to do so again, particularly now that there's a war. Given that history, the Ukrainian government had been paying special attention to the country's largest state-owned oil and gas company, something called Naftogaz.
You know, Naftogaz is a very large organization that...
Greg Rattray used to be the chief information security officer at J.P. Morgan Chase. He's retired Air Force. And before the war, he'd been working with Ukraine to develop a cyber strategy. They were focused on how to protect infrastructure and companies like Naftogaz.
And they are a large target with significant exposure because to perform their mission and to do it and to use technology to do so creates a big attack surface.
In other words, if Russia were to attack Naftogaz and manage to take the company offline, it could have enormous consequences. Which is why Volodymyr Pavelko, sitting in his house in a furry vest, thought GC3, his public-private partnership, might be able to help. It was the Ukrainian version of one of those old Brooklyn deals. He knew a guy who knew a guy who might know some other people who might lend a hand. It turns out that around the same time that Vol began looking for extra help protecting Naftogaz and other critical infrastructure in Ukraine, Greg Rattray was looking for ways he could lend a hand.
I think the invasion was on a Thursday. On the Monday following, I started to call people.
It wasn't presented as a public-private partnership as much as a call for help. Companies like Mandiant and Software and Recorded Future just stepped in. And, full disclosure, Click Here is an editorially independent news arm of Recorded Future.
I think it was easier because of the sort of clear transgressions of the Russians, of people's basic values, right? And that for what I'm doing, it's mostly involving security companies. And the Ukraine was a place where people were willing to volunteer, you know, quickly to try to figure out what could be done.
They became the Cyber Defense Assistance Collaborative, or CDAC. And after lots of Zoom calls and messages, its American founders and a Ukrainian delegation finally met in person 4 months after the war started in Midtown Manhattan. Volodymyr Pavelko of GC3 think tank was there.
There were up to 6-7 people from US side, but online there were a dozen more.
It was supposed to be a short stop, so short that they brought their suitcases with them, rolling them out of the elevators and parking them in the corner of the conference room.
So after the acquaintances, we began to share the present situation, what we have, what challenges do we have, and what kind of need do we need.
Needs, like how a big company like Naftogaz could protect its networks from Russian invaders. Someone from the U.S. cybersecurity firm Mandiant asked Naftogaz if they had access to things like attack surface monitoring or endpoint detection. Think of it as a home alarm system for your network. If someone who isn't supposed to be in there breaks in, it lets you know. Endpoint detection tracks anything in your network that touches the internet, sort of like putting tripwires on doors and windows. With something like that, Mandiant said, Naftogaz could protect its networks. The conversation continued this way for hours. Someone on the Ukrainian side would talk about some cyber problem they were facing, and then someone from CDAC would offer to help.
After our meeting, I felt for sure that our collaboration will come to another level. A lot of people are standing together with Ukraine.
Ron Bouchard is a chief technology officer at Mandiant, and he was at that New York meeting. Just a few days after it took place, he was on the phone with Naftogaz, offering to send hunt teams to look at their networks.
we want to go find out what's happening, right?
Think of a hunt team as a team running software looking for signs of a break-in. The cyber version of dusting for prints, looking to see if something was stolen. And most importantly, whether anything, like malicious code, has been left behind.
So we just do that across thousands and thousands of systems very, very rapidly. And if we see, you know, something from that sweep, we will then pivot to that system and then do a further deep dive of that system. And that is kind of that.
What's different about defending computer networks during a war, Ron realized, is that the perimeter you think you secured is always changing.
You know, in eastern parts of the country, as Russia was taking territory, they were obviously occupying critical facilities, right?
Which after Ron thought about it, explains something that had been bothering him for weeks. Sometimes the cyber attacks launched against Naftogaz's systems looked like they were coming from inside the company, and Ron couldn't figure out why. Turns out, that was because Russian hackers were taking over Naftogaz data centers as soon as they overran Ukrainian towns. And then they started attacking the company from there.
Russia was coming from inside the building, right, or inside the network, because they had physically captured that data center or that system so they could plug in their own systems and continue.
Then they could attack other parts of Naftogaz.
Almost like you're dealing with, almost like an insider threat.
So they adjusted.
If you know they're about to fall, right, if you're retreating from a certain province or a certain city, you know, we were starting to recommend that, you know, you start to segment those systems off of the network before they fell into enemy hands.
Naftogaz told employees to contact supervisors if their towns were overrun by Russian soldiers, so their access to the network could be cut. Vol from the GC3 think tank said people would literally call Naftogaz as they were fleeing.
Just 5 minutes after he left the checkpoint, he made a call to his supervisor.
Once that kind of reporting started happening and Naftogaz could adjust perimeter security to reflect events on the ground, Ron said the mysterious insider threats went away. These days, more than 24 members of CDAC convene meetings once a week. Vol acts as a bridge between Ukrainian officials and the U.S. tech world, collecting lists of what Ukraine needs, presenting them at virtual meetings, and then the cyber posse tries to find someone who can help.
Licenses, technical solutions, and consultations, till today, on the free-of-charge base.
And it all began with a few phone calls. A guy who knew a guy, who knew a guy, who knew a guy in a furry vest who knew someone else who was willing to help.
The spirit which was in the room that time showed us that a lot of people are standing together with Ukraine.
And this could be a model for public-private partnerships going forward. The question is whether you need a crisis or a war to do it. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host and executive producer of Click Here, a podcast about the world of cyber and intelligence. This piece was produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. Remember back at the beginning of the Russian war in Ukraine when we were all tracking what was happening with the Russian oligarchs' yachts? Who was repositioning them? Which ones were being seized? Well, there are Ukrainian oligarchs too, and we've got an update on one of their yachts for you. Viktor Medvedchuk was a pro-Russian politician in Ukraine and a close friend of Vladimir Putin's. That was until he was arrested and thrown into a Ukrainian prison last year on charges of treason and financing terrorism. He escaped just days after the war broke out in February. But then in April, Volodymyr Zelensky went on Ukrainian TV to celebrate his recapture. Since then, Medvedchuk has been delivered to Russia in exchange for Ukrainian prisoners of war, but one of the oligarch's prized possessions was left behind.
Introducing motor yacht Royal Romance. This 92.5-meter motor yacht was built by FedEx.
Yachting International Radio, yes, there is such a thing, devotes a whole video to the super yacht, which is nearly the length of a football field. And yes, it's pretty fancy, with 4 decks and 6 guest suites.
Her features include a beauty salon, elevator, beach club, gym, and a 12-meter pool which flows into a waterfall.
Royal Romance was seized last month by Croatian authorities in the port city Rijeka. Now, like other seized properties, the Royal Romance is expected to be auctioned. And for the first time, the plan is for the proceeds to go straight to Ukraine. The date of the auction has not yet been announced, but Yachting International Radio puts its value at around $200 million. Japan's supporters had a heck of a ride at the Men's World Cup in Qatar yesterday.
Japan have done it again!
The team came from behind to beat favored Spain 2-1 and advanced to the round of 16. Cameras caught fans crying tears of joy in the stands. After the match, one fan told the media that it was, quote, the most emotional moment of my life. Today, the stadiums in Doha were packed once again with soccer fans from around the globe. Including one longtime fan from Cameroon. Henri Mouebe has been rooting for the Indomitable Lions, Cameroon's national team, for 40 years. These days he goes by his fan name, Ngando Pickett. More on that later. He's been to 16 Africa Cup of Nations tournaments and 2 World Cups. And Pickett doesn't just show up and cheer, he goes all out. This was him screaming victory while marching into the stadium at a recent World Cup game. From the waist up, his body is painted in the colors of Cameroon's flag. Green, red, and yellow stripes with a yellow star in the middle right above his belly button. Pickett is also known for his dance moves. He almost looks like he's hula hooping with his arms raised in the air. That's what earned him his nickname, Ngando Pickett, in honor of the late American soul singer Wilson Pickett, who had similar dance moves. He even has a side gig, performing at local parties, weddings, and events in a dance group he founded. The Cameroonian Pickett is also known to let out an intimidating growl.
Prêt pour la bataille.
He says he's ready for battle. This dedication to the team has taken Pickett from superfan to unofficial mascot. You can even get little Pickett figurines. The Cameroonian Football Federation has taken notice. They flew him to Qatar for the opening of the World Cup's new Lusail Stadium and invited him to the opening ceremony of the tournament. In 1922, a Ukrainian choir performed at New York's Carnegie Hall. The audience didn't know it then, but they heard a song that would end up becoming a worldwide Christmas sensation. Now, 100 years later, another choir from Ukraine, a country under siege, is visiting Carnegie Hall to celebrate the famous melody. Lydia Tomkiw has the story from New York.
St. John's Episcopal Church in the West Village, a choir of 54 girls and boys are practicing the Ukrainian song Shchedrik that gave their choir its name. Anastasia Rusina joined the group when she was 4 years old and loves singing. Now 15, this is her first trip to the U.S. and she's very excited. The well-lit church sanctuary is a stark contrast from the conditions she has been practicing under back home, as Russia has bombed civilian infrastructure in Kyiv and other cities.
We have been rehearsing with no light, like almost all the time. And when there are sirens, we would go to the basement and we would rehearse there with no lighting, but like with our phones.
Esther, 12, and Olha, 11, are among the choir's youngest members, also here for the first time.
Yes.
The young singers traveled from Ukraine as well as cities across Europe where some fled following Russia's February invasion. They know they are on a mission of cultural diplomacy. Olha is ready, but a little nervous. I want to express thanks to them for helping Ukraine, she says of Americans. And I want them to hear how nicely we sing in Ukraine. Anastasia loves singing the original Shchedrik.
I just love the melody. I think it's very hypnotizing.
Shchedrik comes from a genre of Ukrainian songs called Shchedryovke that welcome the start of the new year. The Ukrainian lyrics have nothing to do with bells or Christmas, but instead tell the story of a swallow beckoning the master of the house to look at the bounty the coming spring will bring. Composer Mykola Leontovich wrote Shchedrik in 1916. This recording is from the 1922 visit to New York City.
Tina Pirasunko is a researcher and leading expert on the history of Shtetl. I reach her in Kyiv during a window when she has electricity and internet access.
Взагалі-то історія Щедрика це історія української боротьби за незалежність.
The story of Щедрик is the story of the Ukrainian fight for independence. In 1917, the Romanov dynasty fell, and the first modern Ukrainian state was declared in 1918. It was during this tumultuous moment in history that the Ukrainian government sent a choir abroad on a mission of cultural diplomacy, hoping to gain allies. They toured Europe in more than 100 U.S. cities, including that 1922 performance at Carnegie Hall. But the republic soon fell, and the Soviets killed many Ukrainians while consolidating power, including, in 1921, composer Leon Tovich, who never saw how his work spread around the world. In 1936, American Peter Wolosky turned Shtetl into Carol of the Bells when he wrote the famous English lyrics. Pirasunko says research around the song wasn't allowed during Soviet times. Unfortunately, the context of this 100-year anniversary is current, because Ukraine today is again waging a war for independence, is fighting against Russian occupation, and again, Russian propaganda is telling the world the Ukrainian nation doesn't exist. The parallels in history aren't lost on the children's choir conductor, Mariana Sablina. It happened in a way you could not even dream up. But I think the importance of Ukrainian culture is constant, not situational, she says, referencing the attention Russia's war has brought to Ukrainian culture. Leah Batstone, creative director of the concert, hopes culture can help fight propaganda narratives.
Since the start of the full-scale invasion, it's become even more important for us to do this project more urgent because we need to, you know, counter culture as a means of countering the ridiculous Russian propaganda claim that Ukraine isn't a real place, doesn't have its own history, its own culture.
Batstone began work on the concert before the full-scale invasion and hopes larger audiences hear Ukrainian music.
As a former musician, as a musicologist, as an educator, I think that Ukrainian music is really special and unique and deserves a space in kind of the canon of what is regularly performed around the world.
Shtetl will again ring out at Carnegie Hall during the concert Notes from Ukraine. And this weekend, audiences will hear so much more of Ukraine's musical history, both past and present day. For The World, this is Lydia Tomku in New York City.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here Monday.
A quick note before we go. Now through December 31st, your donation to The World's fall fundraiser will go twice as far. A generous donor is offered to match your gift dollar for dollar up to $67,000. So if you give $100, The World will receive $200. This is a big deal for us. I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. Again, that's theworld.org/give. Thanks very much.